Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC. So here are two contrasting speech excerpts from this campaign season regarding racial inequality. First, Reverend William Barber, who'll be on live as a guest in just a minute. He's the leader of North Carolina's NAACP. He's the civil rights correspondent for The Nation magazine and leader of the Moral Mondays movement, which has staged weekly events around voting rights and other issues. And if you tuned in early to watch Hillary Clinton's Democratic Convention speech, you may have seen Reverend Barber's 10-minute barn burner about an hour before the candidate. You might call it a political sermon.
Jesus, a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew, called us to preach good news to the poor, the broken, and the bruised, and all those who were made to feel unaccepted.
Here's a longer excerpt, about a minute and a half, from a stretch that his magazine, The Nation, identified as the heart of the speech. We've edited out audience applause for time.
I say to you tonight that some issues are not left versus right or liberal versus conservative. They are right versus wrong. We need to embrace our deepest moral values and push for a revival of the heart of our democracy. When we fight to reinstate the power of the Voting Rights Act, and we break the interposition and nullification of the current Congress, we in the South especially know that when we do that, we are reviving the heart of our democracy. When we fight for 15 and a union, and universal health care, and public education, and immigrant rights, and LGBT rights. We are reviving the heart of our democracy. When we develop tax and trade policies that no longer funnel our prosperity to the wealthy few, we are reviving the heart of our democracy. When we hear the legitimate discontent of Black Lives Matter and we come together to renew justice in our criminal justice system, we are embracing our deepest moral values and reviving the heart of our democracy.
Reverend William Barber from his Democratic Convention speech. He'll join us live in just a minute. By contrast, Donald Trump in the last week has made some explicit appeals to Black voters and Latino voters for the first time in his campaign. Here is a minute of that from a speech he gave yesterday in Akron, Ohio.
Poor Hispanic and African American citizens are the first to lose a job or to see a pay cut when we don't control our borders. Hillary Clinton's plan amounts to total and absolute total open borders. Open borders. The Democrats have failed completely in the inner cities. Poverty, rejection, horrible education, no housing, no homes, no ownership, crime at levels that nobody's seen. You can go to war zones in countries that we're fighting, and it's safer than living in some of our inner cities. To the African Americans, who I employ so many people, to the Hispanics, tremendous people, what the hell do you have to lose? Give me a chance.
Donald Trump, again with applause and some booing, edited out for time, making a rare appeal to black voters and Latino voters yesterday. With me now is Reverend William Barber, pastor of the Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina. His group, Repairers of the Breach, which is an Isaiah reference from the Bible, is holding a series of revivals around the country this summer. The next one will be in D.C. this Sunday. This is Reverend Barber's third appearance on this program. He was on in March to talk about voting in the North Carolina primary with the state's new voting restrictions, which have since been struck down in court. We'll talk about that. And he was a guest here on Martin Luther King's birthday this year to talk about his book called The Third Reconstruction. Reverend Barber, thanks for continuing the dialogue with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's good to be with you and your audience this morning.
You were already very prominent during your last two appearances, but at least I can say we had you twice before you became a rock star at the Democratic Convention. Can you talk about why you accepted that speech invitation, since I gather you rarely make political endorsements?
Very rarely. In fact, I think it's important to have a nonpartisan push that challenges all parties. You know, black people have had to do that throughout the history of this country. But when you have a candidate like Trump, you know, it would be something you could smile or laugh at if it wasn't so sinister and wasn't so cynical. And the week before, you remember, he stood up and engaged in a form of political idolatry when he said, "I and I alone could fix your problems." I've looked at George Wallace's 1968 speech when he used all the tactics of the white Southern strategy, and you see so much of that in what Trump is doing. It is very dangerous, I believe. It is not just Trump, it's Trumpism, because even with his tone, many in his party have still done the same thing. Remember, it's been McConnell and Ryan and Boehner in the Congress who've done everything they can to block President Obama's agenda to help lift America out of the greatest recession since the Depression. We've seen them block the Voting Rights Act fix for, you know, well over 1,000 days. And in state capitals around the country, like in North Carolina, we've seen, you know, legislators refuse to, you know, engage in voter suppression, refuse to tell the truth about voter fraud. And just recently, the courts said in North Carolina they engaged in intentional discrimination. And even after that, we have a executive director of the Republican Party telling boards of election not to follow the courts, in essence, but to do what the party wants done as it relates to voting. And so Trump represents not just himself, but this extremist mindset that is more about regression and going backwards. And I just felt, you know, after I prayed about it and talked to some advisors, a need to lift this moral call, you know, to the nation at that platform and say that we should embrace, you know, Ms. Clinton, not because any candidate is perfect, but because certainly we have on the polar opposite something that is very, very dangerous, I believe, to the heart of this nation.
Can I get your reaction to the argument that Trump was making in the speech excerpt from yesterday that we just played, maybe with your various hats on, but certainly with your North Carolina NAACP president hat on? He's making a point that after a generation of voting 90% for Democrats, black America is still in the highly unequal state that it's in, and worse in some ways. And he says, what have people got to lose by taking a chance on a different political approach with Trump? What do you think about that new appeal?
Well, we have a lot to lose. You know, in North Carolina, we've seen what happens when you elect extremism in our governor and legislature, and the way in which they have taken North Carolina back in so many ways: health care, public education, voting rights, immigrant rights, LGBTQ rights. But I want to say something to the media. He's not making an appeal to the black community, I don't think. I think that's the storyline with his new people, with Ailes and others, want to get out. And it's a trick. It's an old trick. It's a method of deflection so that the Republican Party doesn't have to deal with its role in the continuance of systemic racism and classism that has hurt poor blacks and whites. It's as old as the strategy that Kevin Phillips designed with the Southern strategy, told Nixon, look, we can do this, but we've got to make the Democratic Party the party of black people, and we have to use these code words, as Lee Atwater later said, to pit blacks and whites against each other. So what he's really doing is he's saying saying to his white audiences, you know, this party hasn't engaged in systemic racism. We don't have to deal with that. The real issue is blacks are their own problem. Now, he's making some assumptions. He's making some assumptions that nobody will call him out and say that the Republican extremists of today are not the Lincoln or even Teddy Roosevelt Republicans who supported voting rights, labor rights, ending slavery, providing health care for all, living wages, and public education. He's also betting that we don't know that since the 60s and all the way through from Kevin Phillips to Robert Ailes, the modern party, Republican Party, sought, especially in the South and in the suburbs, to divide us by race. They've used coded race language like tax cuts, entitlements, reform, states' rights, workers' rights, voters' fraud, in order to racialize and create a disdain for the very social programs that uplifted many whites in the 40s. And lastly, Brian, what he's really trying to do is hope that the American public forgets that the Republican Party today is the Dixiecrat parties of yesterday, and that they have been against voting rights protection, against ending voter suppression, against fully funding public education, against health care for all, against living wages, against labor rights, against immigrant rights. And his party has been a major blocker in doing the kinds of things that would, in fact, help deal with the issues of poverty in the African-American community. And, by the way, would actually be helping poor whites if they were implemented.
Reverend William Barber, our guest on WNYC. Our phones are open at 212-433-WNYC. And I think we have a caller who wants to challenge you. So
Good. Let's
see what Cynthia in Houston has to say or ask. Cynthia, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian and Reverend Barber. Reverend Barber, I saw you on Washington Journal, and I was inspired by your comment. However, one listener asked a question that I didn't think you answered. He asked, what can we learn from Asians because they appear to prosper without many problems in their community? This is something I've been curious about. Would you answer that question directly?
Well, I think that is a very different dynamic, and I think when we say what can we learn, I don't agree with the premise of the question where we pit one against the other. The real issue is what can we learn from American history? What can we learn from the patterns of systemic racism, classism, and what can we learn in this particular season about how particularly, for instance, Donald Trump is trying to deflect and change the subject and trying to raise this issue. If you think about it, he's going to a 99% all-white audience talking about African-American people. He's leaving out so much history. He's trying to say, forget all of the things I've said, all of the policies that I've talked about that are rooted in racism and xenophobia, and somehow now, because I'm Trump on a teleprompter, you forget Trump and what I said when I was speaking from my heart and speaking from my own mindset. You know, American democracy is complicated. And anybody that attempts to dismiss systemic racism, systemic classism, the realities that we face, just does not understand the American process. In fact, I was reading this morning, Brian, a comment where it said the fact that most black people aren't poor, some 26% are, according to University of Michigan's National Poverty Center, and that's unacceptably high. But there are 10% of white Americans that are poor, and that 10% in actual numbers is larger than blacks and Hispanics.
Right.
Now, the question is, what causes whites to vote against their own self-interest and to really vote against many times candidates who stand against all of the kinds of social safety net and uplift program that would actually address poverty? That's
Although,
the question we need to ask.
To follow up on Cynthia's question and maybe take the comparison with Asians directly out of it, a lot of white America and maybe a lot of Asian America looks at black America and thinks many of the ongoing inequality issues are self-imposed 50 years after Jim Crow, 150 years after slavery, such a higher violent crime rate than other groups, not enough two-parent involvement, not enough academic achievement, and even in areas where Title I and other programs make the schools equally funded or more so per student, As a Baptist preacher with a largely black congregation and a growing national audience, there would be many white Americans who would ask, do you spend a lot of time on personal responsibility in addition to all the social responsibility aspects that you rightly talk about, as preachers often do both, or where do you find the right balance of that for our times?
Well, actually, I'm a Christian Church Disciples of Christ minister in a denomination that's predominantly white that is pro-reconciliation and pro-dealing with racial injustice, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I think that there's this, you know, this is something, the Moral Monday movement, as you know, 50 to 60% of the people that got arrested were white. When we challenge the fact that our governor, on the one hand, and many others throughout the South who used this old Southern strategy, and you know by 1969, using the Southern strategy, many whites believed that blacks were doing better than them and had received all of these free things and were the cause of their poverty. That's been the trick of the Southern strategy. But let me just say, yes, black people have always believed in personal responsibility. It's not something new, you know, that even in the days of segregation and Jim Crow, you know, African Americans taught their children to do the best you can, do twice as good. But that does not discount the fact of the fact that in this country, 60%, there's 64 million, for instance, Americans working that do not make a living wage, while we're paying corporate leaders 300 to 400 times more than the average worker. 54% of African Americans make less than a living wage. So you have somebody like a Trump or the extremists in the Republican Party saying, we want to deal with African American poverty as a matter of words, but then as a matter of policy, I'm against living wages. I'm against health care. I'm against fully funding public education. So, for instance, at our church, yes, we have after-school programs. We build homes for low- and moderate-income persons to own their own homes. We have a senior citizen complex. I do a drug dealer gangbanger redemption conference to bring people. But those efforts, that kind of personal charity and social service efforts cannot ever substitute the prophetic social justice effort that challenges the very system that continues to push and cause and the very problems that we're talking about. It's really counterintuitive for somebody like Trump and many Republicans to, on the one hand, say we love the poor and they talk about personal charity, but they never talk about public policy morality.
Sergey in Queens, you're on WNYC with Reverend William Barber. Hi, Sergey.
Good morning, Reverend, and forgive me for changing the topic, but since I've heard your speech at the convention, I wanted to know, what did you mean when you referred to Jesus as a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew? Because the Romans did not rename Judea Palestine until long after the crucifixion happened.
Well, actually, that's not correct. If you look in talk to biblical scholars, the word Palestine comes up long before the Romans. It comes up in biblical scholarship. It can be traced as far back as the days of the Philistines. But the fact of the matter is, I mean exactly what I said, that Jesus is a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew. We could even go further than that. We could say who was profiled by the government, who was killed by a state death penalty because he stood with the poor, he stood with the marginalized, he stood with those who Rome disdained and did not like. There's a great book by Philip Eastler called on Luke and Acts and the context and history of Luke and Acts. He was killed on a cross because he was seen as an agitator. He was seen as someone who stood up for justice because, you know, crucifixion was reserved for those who took on the Roman government, who stood against the kind of religious ideology that catered more to the wealthy and the rich and the powerful and the oppressor rather than to the poor, the least of these, and those who were made to feel unacceptable. And so I meant exactly what I said, and it's so important to make that distinction when we talk about Jesus, I believe.
And we played that clip before, so some people have heard it for the first time in the last few minutes. It strikes me that you were making a common humanity point by referring to Jesus as a Palestinian Jew and putting those two descriptors back to back.
Exactly. And also, Brian, as you notice, I said that we are restoring the heart of this nation and maintaining our greatest values when we love the Jewish child and the Palestinian child, the Buddhist and the Hindu, the Muslim and the Christian, and even those who do not have faith but who love this country and who believe in the deep moral constructs of our Constitution. You know, that is who we are as America, but more importantly, who we are as should be as human beings. You know, one of the great challenges we have in this country, Brian, is that the so-called evangelical right, religious right, has so worked for years to reframe the moral discussion in this country. They did it, started it really, you know, after the rise of the social gospel movement in the early 1900s and the way it impacted the public policy of Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And people, many big business persons, if you read a book by Kevin Cruz called One Nation Under God, he really explores how there was this deliberate attempt to limit the moral conversation to things like prayer in the school, women's rights, and where you stand on homosexuality, which is so far away from the major thrust of moral discussions and justice discussion in the Bible. I'm a Christian, but even in the Old Testament, the Jewish part of the Bible, there are more than 2,000 scriptures in the entire Bible that deal with the issue of love, justice, mercy, how you treat the least of these, not just from a matter of personal charity, but from a matter of public policy. And it's amazing to me. And this is why our moral revival is challenging the so-called evangelical right. I don't like to use the term right when I think people are wrong, because it is a form of theological malpractice when you say so much about what the scriptures and our values say so little, and so little about what the scriptures say so much.
Lucy in Ossining, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lucy.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 50-year-old mom who raised three successful black children, and we can take something from the Asians because, honestly, Asians are succeeding. Whites are not. Whites can also take a lesson from the Asians, and the bottom line is education. And it does. And we know that there's systemic racism all throughout the country, and there will always be racism. But you can still succeed, and I think what it is it's hard work, it's education, and Asian students, they work hard and they continue to work hard, and a lot of white students and black students don't want to put in that hard work. And I was a teacher in a school district, and I see it from kindergarten. They don't have the same work ethic, and I think that's where the problem is.
Well, Brian, that's an interesting comment. My father had two master's degrees in the 1960s and working on his doctorate. My mother had a business degree, was trained as a major concert pianist. But in 1963, when I was born, they still didn't have protected voting rights or protected civil rights. You know, I graduated from North Carolina Central with honors, Duke with honors, a Dean Scholar, Drew University. I've attended MIT. I have children that are all in college. One's a physicist, one's in law school, one's a PhD from Harvard, one's, you know, getting a double major. But all of them also.
But it's not about you, right? The caller's saying it's not about
you. Well, there's a lot about, you know, I think it can, but you know, that it's a misnomer. It's a misnomer to say it's like a pool table. If you tilt the pool table up on the end and say make the shot, somebody's going to make that shot. Somebody's going to be a trick pool type. But that's not how you're supposed to play pool. It's supposed to be level. And for me as a person of faith, faith says unto whom much is given, much is required. The reality is, the sister just talked about education. Let's talk about it. A report just came out that said over 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, poverty and resegregation is are the number one challenges in American schools. If a student is forced to go to a high poverty, resegregated school, where there's high teacher turnover, the course offerings are not there, you cannot then turn around and say if that child does not perform, it's because they did not work hard. Nor can you say if somebody makes it through that school that they worked hard and everybody else should do it. The fact is everybody shouldn't have to do it. So we cannot, on the one hand, lift up persons who have made it a certain way and then turn around and say the inequalities and the racism should just be ignored, the classism should just be ignored, the fact that parents don't have a living wage should just be ignored, and somehow people should just make it. We don't do that to corporations when they fail. When corporations fail, we bail them out with free money and say they're too big to fail. Well, if corporations are too big to fail, human beings and children and communities are too important, too made in the image of God to be told, just work hard.
Let me play, just work hard. Before you go, let me play one more short piece of your convention speech and ask you to talk about it. This is where you specifically refer to Isaiah and the name of your current group, Repairers of the Breach.
The prophet Isaiah cries out, "What I'm interested in seeing you doing, says the Lord, as a nation is, pay people what they deserve. Share your food with the hungry. Do this, and then your nation shall be called a repairer of the breach."
Can you just talk about that biblical concept, repairers of the breach?
Yeah. It's actually a concept that is in the Jewish tradition, and actually Jesus lifts it up in the Gospel of Luke when he talks about preaching good news to the poor. He's quoting from 58, 59, 16, 61 of Isaiah. But here's the concept, Brian. That admonition is the prophetic word, is the prophet in the public square speaking directly to governments. And say, and actually, King James says, "Loose the bands of wickedness." And in Hebrew, that can be translated, "Pay people what they deserve." And there's more in that litany. I had to abbreviate it.
Uh-huh.
But you've heard presidential candidates say, "America is a city sitting on a hill," or "We shall be called the repairers of the breach." Well, Isaiah says, "No, you're not a repairer of the breach." In other words, repairer of the separations that are caused by classism and racism and other isms, unless you deliberately turn your policies in a way as a government, not individual charity, but the policies of the government that pay people what they deserve, lift up the poor, give people the health care. In other words, put the marginalized at the center of your public policy. And if you lift those at the bottom, guess what? Everybody benefits. You lift the whole society. And that's the only way in the sight of God's moral construct and righteousness construct can a nation be considered a repair of the breach. And if I use the language of our Constitution, that's the only way we can be a nation that establishes justice and provides for the common defense and promotes the general welfare. That's the challenge, and that's why we're having these revivals across the country. And that's why next week on the 29th, we're going to actually announce an action. I hope I can come back and talk about it in 25 state capitals on September the 12th. We need a revolution of moral values. We need to, once again in the public square, talk about economic sustainability, living wages, health care for all, public education, criminal justice reform, and equal protection under the law for everybody, women's rights, immigrant rights, and protecting voting rights, not just as political left-right issues, but as moral issues that are at the very heart and core of who we are or who we aren't as an American society.
Last question. Since you talk about the breach and you mentioned reconciliation before, use that word, we're going to be doing some programming here on the station next month around the idea of race, truth, and reconciliation in the United States. South Africa had its famous truth and reconciliation process after apartheid, and there are other examples, as you know, from around the world. I actually think it's more complicated here than it was in South Africa. But as someone who thinks about repairing the breach, do you think at all about racial reconciliation, a reconciling of history, and what that might look like?
All the time. In fact, that's why, for instance, one of the stories I can tell you in the Moral Monday movement is when I was invited to go out to a place called Mitchell County in North Carolina. That's 99% white, 89% Republican. It was after we had done 13 weeks of Moral Monday, and I was asked, most of the people out there are Republican and white. They invited us to come out, and we did, and we talked about, we got away from left versus right. That's why I think we can have more reconciliation if we get away from left and right and talk about what's moral and what's immoral, what I call constitutionally consistent, morally defensible, and economically sane. And we now organize in that county. We have a branch of the NAACP up there that's probably 95% white. Many of them are Republicans. But when we started looking at the issues of public education and health care and living wages and labor rights, they saw that the extremists who had said to them, elect me, I'll push prayer in the school, I'll be against abortion, I'll be against homosexuality, fed them those things as divisive terms, and then went to the General Assembly and actually voted against their own self-interest in the mountains of North Carolina. Mm. One of my colleagues, and I hope we can come on together, Jonathan Wilson Hargrove, was a former staffer for Strom Thurmond, was fed the language and the litany of the white Southern strategy. We now work together. We work together in repairs of the breach, and we actually do a lot of training among persons who in some ways have told us they were brainwashed by the so-called religious right and have really begun to read the Bible afresh and really begun to reconsider and reanalyze moral perspectives afresh. So as a person of faith, one of the reasons, even though I may critique someone, I try to always speak in terms of love and justice and critique their policies as opposed to demeaning and diminishing and demonizing them as an individual, is because I have to believe, I'm commanded to have hope and commanded to believe that there is possibility for those who may be enemies to become friends.
Reverend William Barber, thank you so much for coming on with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend. God bless you and your audience.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening today, everybody. We have a little men's health and a little women's health to do now. Let's see. It's a little after 11 o'clock, and I'm sure a lot of you out there have gone through or maybe are currently going through your morning beauty regimen. That means shampooing your hair, smearing on creams, lotions, soaps, deodorants, lipsticks. It's just your mundane daily routine. But how much do you stop and think about what's in that stuff? What are you putting on your face? What are you putting in your eyes, all over your body? We assume what we use on our bodies is safe, but in fact, the cosmetics industry is largely unregulated in this country, and the FDA has little power to act, even if some products are found to be dangerous, to contain mercury, formaldehyde, even lead. But now there's a big legislative push to change that, and major personal care product companies are signing on, the major ones are, while little ones are opposed and fear they may be driven out. With us now is Rachel Abrams, reporter for the New York Times. She recently co-authored an investigative piece with Eric Lipton entitled "Their Hair Fell Out, Should the FDA Have the Power to Act?" Hi, Rachel. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And with Rachel, we have Assistant General Counsel Tina Sigurdsson from the Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting human health and the environment. Tina, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Rachel, what's the current relationship, as you reported on it, between the FDA and companies that produce cosmetics in this country?
Well, it's been a really long slog, and I think that up until recently, there wasn't much consensus about how to really well regulate the industry. And what we've seen in the past year or so is we've seen the really big players, the Johnson & Johnsons, the Procter & Gambles, the multi-billion-dollar companies that make so much of what's in our bathrooms, we've seen them reach an agreement over one major piece of legislation that has the backing of Senator Dianne Feinstein and others to give the FDA more power. And this was seen as a really big victory both for the health and environmental groups and also for the industry. What's happened in the and more recently than that, around the same time, some of the smaller players decided that they could not get on board with that, that the regulations would be too onerous. And so the cosmetics industry right now has splintered. And you've got two groups backing different pieces of legislation. The other one is widely seen. It was introduced by or sponsored by Pete Sessions. And that's widely seen as being much weaker and not giving the FDA the power it needs. And so right now there's basically sort of a divide among the industry groups about how best to tackle this issue.
Tina, for you as a public health lawyer, what's your main priority here?
Our main priority is protecting consumers and protecting families.
a lot of people aren't aware that this term cosmetic actually covers products used by the entire family from birth to death, baby wipes, shampoo, deodorant, body wash, conditioner. The average woman uses 12 products a day. The average man uses 6. So our goal here is to have consumers protected not only from short-term injuries, but also from long-term exposures to chemicals of concern that we don't know enough about, carcinogens, endocrine disruptors, things like that.
So some of the ingredients which have been found in cosmetics products, mercury, lead, formaldehyde, Tina, do they show up on the labels on, you know, the back of the shampoo bottle or whatever?
In some cases, ingredients, risky ingredients will. In other cases, they won't. When they don't, they should be there, and FDA does have authority to act. But also, the portion of FDA that works on cosmetics is very small and very underfunded. And that's why we need to pass the Personal Care Product Safety Act so that FDA has both the resources and the tools that it needs to protect consumers.
So, Rachel, in your Times article entitled "Their Hair Fell Out, Should the FDA Have the Power to Act?" you focused on the high-end hair care product called WEN, W-E-N, which, by the way, I always thought was a wart or a cyst, not exactly a name I associate with a beauty product. But here's an ad for WEN with a bunch of celebrities, Alyssa Milano, Ming-Na, Holly Robinson, Pete Rosalind Sanchez, which aired in 2013.
Shampoos and conditioners, so yesterday. You want to have beautiful hair, you have to try WEN.
Just try WEN one time, and you're going to see a difference in your hair.
I will never go back to shampoo. Never, never, never. I'm a WEN girl.
But here's a Chicago hairdresser named Judy Santiago telling WGN-TV in Chicago that she had to tell one of her clients that she was losing her hair this past January.
It was the exact size of a thumbprint, and it was like balled down to the scalp, so it's not like it broke off.
So the company received more than 21,000 complaints from people who said that the product made their hair fall out, and yet they were not required to give any of that information to the FDA, Food and Drug Administration. Is that what you found, Rachel?
Yeah, I mean, I think people don't really understand that companies are under very little obligation to report problems with their products. I mean, even if somebody dies from a cosmetic product, that company, that manufacturer, has no obligation to report that to the federal government. And I don't really think most people understand that. So what some folks are trying to do, what the Feinstein bill deals with, is trying to get the companies to be required to report adverse effects, basically problems with the products within a certain amount of time. So for serious problems, serious adverse health effects, the companies would be required to report them within 15 days to the FDA, and would be required to make an annual report of all adverse effects, obviously every year. So I think that's sort of seen as something that seems kind of basic by a lot of health and environmental advocates.
So, Tina, this Feinstein-Collins bill, Dianne Feinstein, Susan Collins, co-sponsors, a Democrat and a Republican in the Senate, has actually won the endorsement of the industry heavyweights, including Estee Lauder, Johnson & Johnson, the maker of Neutrogena and Aveeno, and Procter & Gamble, whose brands includes Pantene, Head & Shoulders, Herbal Essence, and Olay. But then there are these other smaller companies like Mary Kay Cosmetics, speaking for small business owners, who are saying, we don't want this. This is going to put us at a competitive disadvantage because we can't comply with this. Do you understand, Tina, the split in the industry, and what would you say to the smaller manufacturers?
You know, that's a great question. I would say that the time for reform is long overdue. The tools that are proposed in the Personal Care Product Safety Act are both reasonable and necessary. And, you know, I think there just needs to be a little more education and outreach to small businesses about the various ways that the bill does consider them and about what this would mean for them. Because we're talking about an industry that's gone largely unregulated for 80 years. So, of course, the prospect of regulation might seem a little bit daunting to some folks. And that's why we're hoping to see a hearing in Congress. We're hoping to see a hearing in the Senate. Be great to talk about the bill, talk about these issues, and raise greater awareness about what it actually does.
Rachel, how do you understand the smaller company's argument? Is it economically prohibitive for a smaller cosmetics company to tell people if there's formaldehyde in the shampoo or whatever else the Feinstein-Collins bill would do?
I think for the smaller companies, the biggest concern that they have is they don't want a patchwork of state regulations. They want any kind of federal legislation to say, hey, our rule is the rule, and you can't do anything different on the state or the local level. Because what their concern is that, and the majors share this concern as well, but the smaller manufacturers are super concerned that it's going to be difficult for them to comply with a bunch of different sets of regulations. And if you don't expressly prohibit that, that's going to be a problem. And so the legislation backed by the smaller manufacturers has more tight provisions to prevent that from happening, because the smaller guys just don't have the infrastructure in place to hire a bunch of lawyers, spend millions and millions of dollars on R&D, research and development to really, you know, tackle more than just sort of one broad set of regulations.
Well, if it's a federal bill, if it's a federal law that might emerge from this, why wouldn't that establish one national set of regulations and they wouldn't have that problem?
I think the idea is that because under the Feinstein proposal, that proposes that the FDA look at five chemicals of concern every year. So the first five they would tackle, a couple of them are formaldehyde preservatives and things that people have been really concerned about. But if I'm not mistaken, and maybe Tina can address this too, there's a little bit more wiggle room for states to kind of look at or other chemicals before the FDA might have a chance to get to them. And so I think that that is an area of concern for some companies.
Tina, more on that?
Yeah, I would contrast the Personal Care Product Safety Act, where there would be a review of five ingredients a year and then some compromise on the preemption issue, with the House bill. In the House bill, there would be no ingredients reviewed by FDA whatsoever. In fact, the bill would actually rubber stamp many, many ingredients as safe without adequate information, and then go ahead and preempt state action. So, I mean, it's shocking to be able to say this. We're talking about an outdated 1938 law, but the House bill would actually make things worse than current law because it wouldn't really reform regulation of cosmetics, and then it would prevent states from acting to protect their citizens. So, I mean, I think that the Personal Care Product Safety Act is a great bipartisan compromise bill, and we just need to have a hearing to talk more about it.
Let's take a phone call. Claire in Yorkville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Claire.
Oh, yes, hi there. I was just thinking that I wanted to make a contribution because I was in the pharmaceutical industry for 30 years in various aspects of what they call safety.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, a lot of the adverse events, of course, we were regulated by the FDA, but we got a lot of what they call anecdotal reports. So, for example, with regard to the hair loss, you know, hair loss is a consequence of aging for the normal population. So unless there's like a controlled, blind clinical study done about that, you really cannot determine if somebody who's calling you reporting this loss, whether it was really caused by the drug. In addition, in my experience, there are groups of attorneys, class action lawsuits, who actually go and recruit, put big ads out there. Have you been damaged by product X? Join our group. So that really, you know, makes a lot of companies worried about what they're putting out, and that's kind of related to why many medications are expensive, because they have to participate in these lawsuits where they would rather just pay off somebody than going through all the effort of having to prove every case.
With your experience, what's the solution?
I think it's good. I was only listening a little bit, but, you know, once again, they were talking about the five chemicals that need to be identified and researched. I mean, I actually have a friend at Mount Sinai who's working on, oh, I can't think of the name of the word, but it's these little chemicals.
Microbeads?
No, those are actually physical things. This is it's a chemical. It's related to a scent. And so, in other words, there's a huge amount of research going on, but it takes time to figure out, you know, first of all, maybe what happens in 1 year, but then a lifetime of experience. You know, that's sort of an epidemiological problem.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, I'm in favor of it, really, but it's a very, very
right.
expensive proposition.
Right, the difficulty of doing those prospective, as they call them, public health studies over decades to see what the actual impact of these products or these additives into the products are. So let's finish on that point. Rachel, is that part of the bill? I mean, if they're going to look at five chemicals a year, if they pass this Feinstein-Collins bill, well, for how long do they need to study a chemical in a cosmetic before they determine scientifically that it's the cause of anybody's health problems?
I think, you know, it's really interesting that you ask that, because I think that the FDA is also sort of tackling that issue too, because you have to look at both acute effects, stuff that's going to happen in the short term, right, and then also maybe the less well understood long-term effects, stuff that could be harmful to development and to other sort of maybe early stage growth. And so that stuff is a little bit harder to measure, and maybe it takes a little bit longer. And I think the FDA is trying to figure out how to kind of address both short-term and long-term problems.
Tina, last word on the same question?
Yes, I really think the Personal Care Product Safety Act and needed cosmetic reform is just about getting more information from companies, gathering the information they already have on the safety of their ingredients. And, you know, as your caller raised the point of class action lawsuits, it was only EWG doing investigations in the fall where we found in class action litigation documents that Guthy Ranker, the maker of Wendt, had received 17,000 complaints. And in that same period of time, FDA has only received 127. So if we have a situation where the company is getting 21,000 complaints now and FDA is only getting 127, we have a broken system, and we have companies that need to come forward with more information about complaints and about the safety of their products.
All right. We have to leave it there with Rachel Abrams, business reporter for The Times. She recently co-authored an investigative report with Eric Lipton entitled "Their Hair Fell Out, Should the FDA Have the Power to Act?" and Tina Sigurdsson, assistant general counsel from the Environmental Working Group. Thanks so much to both of you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
No, you're not waking up at 6:05 in the morning. Instead of the Brian Lehrer Show theme, we're playing the Morning Edition theme right now, because today is Sotirios Johnson's last day with us live on the show. Tomorrow is his last day at WNYC. After hosting Morning Edition for 14 years, he's going to go have a new life in California, and we are declaring this Sotirios Johnson Appreciation Day, and our phones are open for you to call in for just the next few minutes and say out loud to Sotirios what his presence has meant in your life as a listener, and ask him anything about being a super morning person or whatever at 212. First the news. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That was an instant. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So while people's calls are coming in, Sotirios, you're taking a job at the University of California at Davis?
That's right, yes. I'm going to become the director of Humanities, Arts, and Cultural Partnerships as part of this Engaged Scholarship Initiative. That basically, Engaged Scholarship is a movement to take what universities do, the work that they do and the research that they do, and to try to find practical applications in the community. So it's a public service on the one hand, but it's also a mutually beneficial thing, because not only does the community get something out of it, but also the researchers and the academics actually get access to the people in the community, and they get it really informs the work that they do. So it's a really a mutually beneficial thing.
So you're staying on the mission-driven side of things.
Yes,
that's
I guess
good. And I guess we can reveal that this is a family decision as well. You've actually had a bi-coastal marriage for a while now, since your other half took a job out there.
That's right. It's been about 2 years, so this will allow us to live together again, which is I'm looking forward to as well. It'll be a really great thing.
That's great. Now, at the risk of embarrassing you, there were a few years there when if you did a certain kind of Google search for Sotirios Johnson, the first thing that came up was Sotirios Johnson is not black. How did that meme get started?
I'm guessing that, you know, I get that a lot. I'm guessing it's because of my unusual name, my unusual first name, and then my very common last name. And I think the combination really throws people off. I think that's probably what it is. I don't know. I've actually met, so I'm of Greek descent. I am not black. And I've actually met people from Greece who have met me for the first time and they actually said, we thought you were black.
Huh.
So, yeah. So, I mean, it just
is happens. It a common Greek first name?
It is fairly common. It's not unusual at all.
And so you've gotten that over the years. I mean, all of us in radio meet listeners for the first time and hear the line, oh, you don't look anything like I pictured you. But you got a lot of, oh, I thought you were black.
Right. Yes. I thought you were black. I thought you were taller, and I thought you were older. So,
or are you black in passing?
I would say I'm black on the where it counts, on the inside.
Ooh, very good. Marjorie in Queens, you're on WNYC with Sotirios. Hi.
Hi, Sotirios. I have to compliment your voice. Means so much to me in the morning. I'm not a morning person. But when I hear your voice, the tenor, the tone, it lifts my spirits. You have such a mellifluous quality. Did you study voice someplace?
I did
your
not.
Voice is amazing.
Oh, Marjorie, thank you so much. I never studied voice. Actually, I took one speech class in college. Just because it was interesting. And I did, in middle school and high school, I performed in the choir. And I think that taught me something about breathing. But I didn't really study voice in any kind of formal way. But thank you so much. It's very kind of you.
All right. Well, he must have been endowed with some kind of a gift because it started very young. Sotirios was embarrassed, but he shared with us a tape that he has at home of himself as, what, like maybe a 9-year-old?
I'm guessing somewhere around 9 years old, yes.
Other kids went out to play baseball or did whatever they did. Sotirios was at home pretending, as we will hear.
And now for our news broadcast. And we just want to identify our station. We are now WGF.
Washington, D.C. Recently, members of the Senate had been concerned about strange noises emanating from one of the offices. They said they heard the sounds of heavy footsteps and furniture moving, coupled with a man moaning, "No, no, please don't take me." A team of exorcists was sent to investigate and discovered it was only Spiro Agnew pleading with an IRS agent and a crew of Beacons men.
And that was the news flashes that we had for today. This is WGF.
Was it a made-up call letter combination there?
You know what it was? I think when I started that, I found this tape. I know my parents moved out of my childhood home a couple of years ago, so of course I had to go and collect all of my stuff, right? So I found this cassette, and I vaguely remember doing that. So we had these records and these comedy records that I was playing with, and so the fake news, the comedy news mm-hmm. broadcast station was WGF. So I had to change. I originally had another call letters, and then I had to change it to that because they were announcing the other.
Yeah, in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Sotirios. Hi.
Hey, good morning. I'm long listening to your show, Brian, and also Sotirios, and a cab driver, waking up early in the morning and. Getting my first passenger and having listening to Sotirios every morning, such a great thing. I mean, I think we're gonna miss his voice. I wish him good luck to whatever he's gonna do. But I just want to say that we love his voice.
Yeah. Thank you very much. So I tried the morning shift one time at another station. And I couldn't do it. I gave it up for a worse job after just 6 weeks because waking up at 3:30 in the morning, which is what it was for me on that shift, was just too painful for me. I then worked overnights for years, like 11 p.m. to 6 a.m., and it was much easier for me. I know it would drive other people crazy. And you said you get up at 3:40.
Right. It's painful.
When do you sleep? Do you just turn out the lights at 8 o'clock 5 nights a week, or do you take a nap in the afternoon and try to have an evening, or what have you done?
So the first couple of years, I was religiously going to sleep at about 8 o'clock or so. But then as the years kind of went on, there was creep. So like I would stay up another 15 minutes, maybe another half hour. So basically at this point, I'm usually lights out at about 10. So I'm only getting about maybe 5.5-6 hours of sleep at most. I do maybe catch a little nap every so often. But, I'll let you in on a little secret, Brian. I am not and I have never actually been a morning person.
Really?
So, yeah, my natural body clock is quite different. It's probably, waking up at 11 a.m. and going to sleep at 3 a.m. It's been a challenge, and it's just – I think I always think of it as just a sheer force of will that I've been able to do this all this.
I once heard the DJ, Pete Fornatel, say when he was a morning man, he thought he would just get 3 or 4 hours of sleep every night, and it would be okay. And he found out quickly that he wasn't, and he was becoming a wreck, and he had to adjust.
Right.
Did you have to go through anything like that?
Yeah, you know, it's like you do – you kind of learn to live with less sleep, I think. And after a while – you know, look, I'm getting older too, so it's not as easy as it was when I started. That's for sure. So one of the things – one of the many things I'm looking forward to is actually being able to sleep when most everyone else is sleeping and also just getting more of it, which will be great. So.
And I think John and Paramus can relate. Hi, John. You're on an early morning schedule?
Oh, yes. Hi, guy. I wish the Terrier is the best of everything, and I'm jealous because I sit up the same time as him, sometimes even earlier. And no matter what anyone says to Terrier, you never get used to getting up at that hour.
I agree with you 100%.
Thank you very much. Sam in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sotiri. Yasu. Tikani.
Ekala. Ευχαριστώ.
Μπράβο, παιδί μου. Εγώ ήθελα απλώς να πω να πα στο καλό. Δεν ξέρω αν με ετοιμάσαι. Είμαι αυτός που είχε το βιβλιοπωλείο στην Αστόρια.
Oh,
και
είχες
παραγγείλει ένα βιβλίο για τη μητέρα σου.
That's right. Okay, so this is a gentleman in Greece who speaks better Greek than I do, in Astoria, who speaks better Greek than I do, who was not born in Greece. You were not born in Greece, I don't think, were you?
No, I was born in Nigeria, but
That's
I went
right.
to medical school in Greece.
Yes.
And then when I migrated here, the first thing I did was run through the radio station. When I heard your voice on WNYC, I was hooked on WNYC.
Oh, well, thank you. I met this man. He owns a bookstore in Astoria, and I was actually buying a Greek language book for my mother, and I hunted it down in his bookstore, and that's how I met him.
Awesome. Sam, thanks for checking in. All right, we have some questions for you that have come in via Twitter from listeners. Joe asked, do people ever recognize you by the sound of your voice?
Usually not. Usually they might recognize me if somebody says my name in public. That's usually when it happens, yeah.
Joanna asks, what part of Greece does your family hail from and have you visited?
I have. So my mom was born in Sparta, and my dad was born here, but his dad was born in Cyprus. He was a Greek Cypriot. And then my father's mom was born kind of southern Greece, south of Sparta, in the Mani.
Let's see. Rachel asks, do you ever moonlight as a raver?
Only in song, not in real life.
Margaret asks, my question is probably obvious, but here it goes. What was the worst pronunciation of your first name?
Oh, gosh, there have been so many. I don't even remember. You know, what's so funny is that, you know, having been on the radio here so long, you know, people now get it right. I know people are listening or are they are listeners when they get it right. Usually, you know, when I was in school, you'd get some new teacher and they would look at your name and they would massacre it. I've got like Soterios. I've got just like anything you can imagine. I mean, Soterios might be the pretty bad one.
That's pretty bad. Siobhan asks, if he could take one New York thing with him, food, amenity, event, to the West Coast, what would it be other than Brian? I'm not available.
You're coming with me because I can stream there. So, I don't know. I think it might have to be New York pizza. It's going to be one of the, you know, bagels are a close second. It's going to be between the pizza and the bagels.
And Leonor writes, tell us something about changes you've seen in the WNYC news team over the years.
Wow. So when I started here back in late 1993, we were a very small news operation. A handful of hosts and reporters. And you remember,
That's
Brian.
Right. I think we had four news people at that time.
Right, right. And plus a couple of – maybe three or four hosts. So total, you know, like eight people. Now we are – I don't even know – I can't even count how many dozens of people we have. We've got producers and reporters. I mean, we are – we have become a news gathering powerhouse here in New York City, making a huge difference. And I've been so privileged and honored to be a part of it. And I feel like, you know, WNYC has become this amazing place.
And I always say during the pledge drives that my number one reason to support the station is that we really do invest in a real local news operation, so rare in this day and age. Do you remember the name of your predecessor as the local host of Morning Edition?
I do.
It is?
Mark Hyland.
Well, guess who's calling in from where he lives now in Ohio? Oh, my God. Mark, is that really you?
Yes, I am here. Middle of Ohio. Ada, small town.
Hey, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
It really is old home week on the station here.
Well, Sozo, I just had to call in because there's a question I've been meaning to ask for a long, long time and never got a chance to ask.
Okay.
I left a green felt tip marker on my desk. Is it still there? Any chance?
I'd have to go back to Center Street to look. I don't think so, though.
I also have to ask you whether or not you got what I used to get all the time, which was, oh, you're Mark Hyland or you're Satirius Johnson. I shower with you every morning.
Oh, I get that a lot. I do. Yes, yes. I wake up to you. I had a dream about you. You know, I kind of like, I think I creep into, I'm sure you did too. You creep into people's subconscious because they're half awake when they're hearing your voice. So they somehow
Absolutely.
Weave their way into your dream. So it's amazing.
Well, I just wanted to say, I know it's never easy to leave, but it sounds like you're leaving to transition to something very, very exciting and something that I'm sure is right down your alley, knowing the kind of person you are. So I wanted to call in and wish you all the luck in the world.
That's so nice. And I know we have a lot of listeners who remember you too fondly, Mark. So maybe you can give Sotirius one piece of advice. Since you moved from here to what you described as a small town in Ohio, maybe Davis, California is a little bigger than that, but what's it like to not live in New York after living in New York?
I'll tell you the absolute truth, and I'll tell you what I tell everybody else that I meet out here that realize that I moved here from New York. First of all, a lot of people joke around with me, and they say, what, did you lose a contest by moving to Ada, Ohio? I will say that my stress level went down appreciably. I have to admit it. My stress level was very, very high in New York City, and my stress level went way down. I don't know how large Davis is, and I don't know whether there are the same or similar types of pressures, but my stress level went way down, and I've really appreciated that just personally.
I'm expecting that to happen. Davis is about 85,000 people, and it's in California. So, you know, I think even when people think they're stressed in California, I think California stress is way lower than New York stress, I think.
And enjoy the sunshine.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks for checking in, Mark Hyland. Wow. About stress level, you gave us a list of some of the memorable stories that you've done here. And I wonder if this one was the most stressful. Kayaking in New York Harbor. You did this as an experiential report, and here is the moment from that story where he almost tips the kayak.
Oh, geez.
Whoa! Stay paddling in the waves. Keep the paddle from
okay.
water. Keep going.
Okay.
But they're much more stable when you paddle.
A lot more stable when you paddle. Paddle, Sotirius, right. Paddle.
I think a big boat had gone by, and we were getting hit by the wake of it, and we almost tipped over. Yeah, that's if you can imagine a non-Jewish Woody Allen trying to kayak New York Harbor, that's kind of like what it was like.
And you don't just have a great voice, as people have been calling up to say. You're really unflappable. I've, like, never seen you get flustered when there's, like, six breaking news stories or anything else. Were you always like that?
I don't know if I was always like that, but I think I think you kind of have to adopt the mantra of like, don't panic when things like that happen, because that's not helpful at all. So you just have to kind of take what's coming and just not panic and stay calm and in the moment.
Oh my goodness, we've started a cascade here of radio people calling in. So we're going to extend the segment a little bit so we can hear from Phil Schaap, the classic jazz DJ. Most known for his work at WKCR, the Columbia station. Phil, is that you?
Indeed it is. And Sotirius Johnson, I don't really go back to WGF, but I was with you in your first broadcast. I guess it's 30 years ago at WKCR, and you were great.
That's right. Thank you. They have 34 years. Well, 30 years ago. You're right. You got it. You know, Phil's got this memory. You can tell him, like, a certain day, and he will tell you the day of the week it was and what happened and when Charlie Parker, you know, had lunch at Katz's Deli. He'll tell you the time and the day. It's amazing. Phil, I have to tell you, though, that cassette we played earlier, the WGF thing, very
yes.
strange coincidence. At the end of it, I had an air check of WBGO. And who do you think
That's
was
the
DJ?
The Newark Jazz Station.
I had, as a child, I heard you on WBGO doing music.
In fact, I was like you. I was the morning man, but I didn't get up at 3:40 because I worked the West End till about 3:40, and I just went out to Newark at first thing in the morning and did what you are going to stop doing. And I admire your perseverance. I'll tell one other thing. I did the analog audio training at KCR 30 years ago, and I had a class with Sotirios Johnson, and he was by far and away the best in it and clearly had the most likely future in broadcasting. And he's always been great. I've run into him a few times on the subway where I didn't recognize his voice. I just recognized him. Mm-hmm. And he's always been as solid a citizen to our trade as we've ever had.
Thank you so much, Phil.
Phil, thanks for checking in. Yeah, you went to the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism.
And undergrad, right? As well. KCR is an undergrad organization.
Ah, so, yeah. You were undergrad at Columbia as well. All right, we'll take one more radio or maybe a television person who maybe is on the morning shift and wants to commiserate. David in Easton, Connecticut. Hi, David.
Hey there, Brian and Sotirios. I can't say as I'm still doing that, but I can appreciate what you went through for a number of years and finally broke the camel's back when the shift, the wake-up time became 1:20 instead of 3:40 or 4:30, as the case might be it on radio or television. So I can appreciate where you're coming from and where you're going to, because sleeping in is going to be a real pleasure for you, I know.
Oh, thank you. I'm looking forward to it immensely.
You have been on the upside of local broadcasting with an increase in the WNYC news family, whereas over my jaded career, I saw the reverse in commercial radio, where it dwindled down to a precious few or none, as the case might be. And that's been painful to see. So WNYC has really been a godsend to so many people in so many different ways.
David, thank you very much for checking it. Now, he's a guy, I don't know him. If you just met him on the subway and you said, excuse me, and he said, no problem, you would know he works in radio.
Right. I think you're right. Absolutely.
I have had the thought about the morning shift that someone in your position could have moved to Europe, where it's 5 or 6 hours later, and you could go to work at like 10 a.m. while hosting Morning Drive for the listeners of New York. Did you ever think of doing that instead of moving to California?
Right. Well, no. And, I never really thought about leaving New York until this California thing came up. But when it came up, someone did say, hey, it's too bad you weren't going in the other direction, because that would actually make a lot more sense for morning radio.
Well, tomorrow is Sotirios Johnson's last day before he starts a new life in California. With his other half, who's been living out there for a few years already. Great that you'll be reunited under one roof. So great working with you, and you can hear how much the listeners love you. So good luck on the left coast.
Thanks so much, Brian, and thanks to New York and everybody else.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.